Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, impeachment comes to a close.
Without objection, the motion is agreed to. The Senate, sitting as a court of impeachment, stands adjourned, sine die.
The president was able to give his State of the Union this past Tuesday night, knowing the impeachment result would conclude in his favor.
So I say to the people of our great country and to the members of Congress, the state of our union is stronger than ever before.
It allowed Trump to take the victory lap the White House had long hoped for. The impeachment has become the most recent example of how divisive our politics have become under Trump. So now that the process is over, what did we learn? Norman Ornstein of the American Enterprise Institute joined me in the studio to give us his thoughts. Norm Ornstein, now that the impeachment process is behind us, how would you evaluate the strategy of the Democrats?
I don't have any real criticism of the strategy of the Democrats. The only thing that I might have considered was having more impeachment counts to cover more of the areas of misconduct by President Trump.
To make it broader.
To make it broader. And I understand why they made it narrower, because they wanted to explain to the American people as best they could a very simple case. And the case that could be explained in one sentence: he coerced an ally and helped the Russians to cheat on the election, period. If anything deserves removal from office, and if you go back and read all the Federalist Papers, including those that talk about foreign influence on our process and on our policy, it's pretty clear cut. On the other hand, we have all these violations of the emoluments clauses to start with. And the courts have limited the standing of those who can sue for violations of emoluments clauses. So the only thing that's left is impeachment. You have a president who's enriched himself every day off of the public dole and has changed American foreign policy towards places like Saudi Arabia because of the investments that he has there. He has seen China give valuable trademarks to his family in return for considerations and policy. But I understand, you know, one of the things we have to remember is that if there's one scandal, it gets reported over and over and over again until it finally penetrates in the larger public consciousness that this is really bad. But if it's a scandal a day or two scandals a day, they all wash over. So to get back to this, focusing on one made some sense. Delaying it made a great deal of sense because more information emerged and you could have a stronger case to make. I thought the House managers, and in particular Adam Schiff, brilliant in the way they handled things. But of course, in the end, it didn't matter in a larger sense, because Republican senators either completely ignored the evidence or distorted it to fit an already made decision about what to do about it.
And one Republican senator voted for witnesses.
That was an interesting dynamic. We had Mitt Romney and Susan Collins say, let's have witnesses. A third one would have made it a 50-50 tie and put some onus on Chief Justice John Roberts presiding, who has the ability to break a tie. Mitch McConnell did not want to put that burden on John Roberts. Almost certainly he would have refused. And, you know, the night before the vote on witnesses, Lisa Murkowski, who made it pretty clear that she thought witnesses would be a good idea, I have no doubt was pressured tremendously by McConnell and caved. And that was a reality for almost all of these senators who know in their hearts, and some of whom said openly, that he violated his oath of office.
And Norm, one has to wonder about the loyalty we are seeing toward this president. Is it really loyalty? What is it?
No, it's not loyalty towards the president. There's no doubt that many Republicans in Congress really do think that he's absolutely wonderful. But, you know, to be blunt, Diane, I don't think we have a Republican Party anymore, a typical traditional American party with an ideology. We have something that's closer to a cult, and it's a theology. And right now, Donald Trump is the cult leader. Now, I think this preceded Trump, but he has taken over this party, and it's his party. What happens in a cult is the fear of being shunned, of being labeled an apostate, a traitor, of being excommunicated, in effect, is so powerful for people. And if you put that into the other larger reality of our politics, which have become tribal, where you view those on the other side as evil and trying to destroy our way of life, and if you criticize your leader, if you undermine your leader, you're giving a victory to those evil people. It's that combination. When I look at a Lamar Alexander, for example, now here's a man in his 80s with a remarkably distinguished career, a governor, successful, a secretary of education, superb, a lifetime of strong public service, retiring from the Senate and not needing to get a job as a lobbyist, not looking at a primary challenge. There is no obvious reason for him to do anything other than to vote what he knows is right, and he doesn't. And why? In my view, it is one, he's loyal to his tribe, and his tribe leader is Mitch McConnell. Two, he doesn't want to be seen as an apostate. Three, he's going to go back to Tennessee. And when he goes out on the golf course or goes out to dinner with his wife and some friends and they're surrounded by their peers, the idea that they would look at him as a traitor, as an apostate, is just too much for him to bear.
So, Norm, you had some Republicans from swing states admit that Trump had done some things that were wrong, but they said it didn't rise to the level of impeachment. Hard to understand.
If this doesn't rise to the level of impeachment, it's hard to imagine what does. It was interesting to me to watch the closing arguments, and the president's lawyer, Jay Sekulow, kept quoting Federalist 65 and Hamilton, and leaving out the most significant part, which is what Hamilton defined as worthy of impeachment. And it was misconduct and betrayal of the public trust. You know, the president's lawyers kept saying, you have to have a violation of a crime. There was no criminal code at the time they put this together. So that's just nonsense. When you do something that is for your own benefit, using the power of the presidency to distort and defame an American election, the hallmark of a democracy, and especially of the election of a president, that's horrible. When you do it by shaking down, coercing an ally, and damaging that ally's security, and aiding and abetting your most bitter rival as a country, Russia, if that is not something worthy of removal from office, then almost nothing is. And some of them said they had to because the evidence was so strong. Yes, he did it. But I must tell you, watching Susan Collins interviewed yesterday and saying he's learned his lesson, it just made me sick to my stomach.
And at the same time, his poll numbers are going up.
So we know that we have a pretty strong economy. We know that in a tribal environment, people who see him under attack, who are his supporters, are going to get stronger behind him. He still has never risen in a reasonable poll above 42% approval. But what we also know from the perspective of those Republicans in the House and Senate, his approval among their voters is 85 to 90%. And they're just very, very reluctant to do something that will alienate or make furious their voters. What that means in terms of the future, I don't know. The other thing that made me so unhappy is Republicans saying, well, this should be decided at the next election. the next election is one in which Donald Trump has already made it clear he will put his thumb on the scales and along with that put the thumbs of the Russians, the Chinese, and through coercion, the Ukrainians, if he can, to tilt the outcome of that election. So we're not looking at a fair election where voters can make that judgment. But even if it were a fair election, the fact is that the nature of the Electoral College and the way voters are distributed means that it's entirely possible that Donald Trump could lose the popular vote this next time by 5 or 6 million, not just the 3 million he lost by the last time, and still eke out an Electoral College victory. And even more frightening, what we know from the behavior of this president is if it's a very close election and it looks like he's lost, he will not only say that the election was rigged, but we can't be sure he'll leave office.
So will Democrats continue even after all this impeachment debate has gone? Will Democrats continue to pursue the issues?
I think they have to, and I believe that it is a moral imperative to continue to investigate wrongdoing by the president. But I also think that Democrats have to be careful about the balance that they pick. This can't be all about going after Donald Trump. And that's partly because if anything, Democrats have to maintain a majority in at least one House of Congress. Think about, Diane, where we would be if Democrats had not captured the House of Representatives last time. The laws probably would have been changed to move us closer and closer towards an autocracy. The corruption would have been ramped up dramatically. We never would have learned about what Trump was doing with Ukraine or with Russia or with Saudi Arabia or with China. So having some check and balance becomes particularly important. And winning the Senate, you know, I think that for many of the Republican senators who are up in 2020, up in November, in states that have significant numbers of suburban voters, like Colorado and Maine, North Carolina, those Republican senators are going to have to answer to constituents who know that they made a bad decision. So, you know, keeping this up, I think, is important. And uncovering more information. And one of the things that Adam Schiff said repeatedly and the other House managers did to senators, don't think that you're going to cast these votes and that there will be nothing more that will emerge. We already know, and this is what's so striking about this, after the vote on witnesses and data, we learn from a court filing that the administration has been withholding and refuses to give up a set of emails that reflect what Trump was thinking and doing about Ukraine. Now, if those were emails that were exculpatory, you can be sure they'd be out there in a nanosecond. And more than likely, they are damning emails. They're emails that show violations of the law. The Government Accounting Office already showed that Trump violated the Budget and Impoundment Control Act by illegally withholding that aid. And undoubtedly, those emails show that it came explicitly from the president. And that puts Republicans, even those who said, well, there's got to be a violation of a law here, in an even worse position. And more will emerge, I am sure, before we're done.
Rudy Giuliani has said he is going to continue to investigate Joe Biden.
And so has Lindsey Graham, who to me embodies just the worst of what we've seen in this last year. And, you know, there is a rich and unfortunate irony here that Lindsey Graham, who coined the phrase, there comes a time when you have to put country over party, who has put party over country over and over again. Lindsey Graham has said that he's going to continue to investigate Biden. And what we also saw,
grounds, Norm?
There are no grounds for investigating Joe Biden. And for Lindsey Graham, who had this very close relationship with Joe Biden, it really makes you wonder what's going on here. At the same time, people who know how significant it is, members of the Senate Whistleblower Caucus, who know that when you're talking about outing the identity of a whistleblower in the intelligence community. You're endangering a person's life, and you are making it far more difficult to uncover misconduct. And Rand Paul, in an act that I would have to say is traitorous to the country of the United States, went on the floor of the Senate after John Roberts, the Chief Justice, refused to ask the question that revealed the alleged identity of the whistleblower, went on the Senate floor with a big placard with his name or her name, and to do that and get no pushback from the other members of the whistleblower caucus. The senator from Tennessee, who is also a member of the whistleblower caucus, at the same time saying we should know that identity, and Lindsey Graham saying that he was going to bring up the whistleblower. And the person who has been the biggest champion of whistleblowers, Charles Grassley, said nothing. There's no act at this point that apparently is so low that people who've in the past demonstrated real integrity will say, I can't go there. And it's just a dismaying factor. It transcends the vote to acquit Donald Trump, because we're looking at a much bigger pathology here, Diane.
A quick break. When we come back, more from Norman Ornstein.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with Norm Ornstein. He's a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, a contributing editor at The Atlantic, and way back in 2012, co-authored a prescient book titled It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Let's talk about the other news this week, and that is the President's State of the Union address. Overall, what did he achieve with that address?
The optics and the theatrics of it were quite impressive. You know, you go back to Ronald Reagan, who started this practice in State of the Union addresses of having guests in the gallery who were used to amplify larger messages. I may be wrong about this, but I think the first one was Lenny Skutnik, an average American who jumped into the frozen Potomac River to save people from an Air Florida flight that had crashed, bringing up heroes and using those kinds of messages. And Trump, who is a master showman, did it with great effect. One part of it that frankly made me cringe a little bit because I thought it was a little bit of a cheap trick was to have the family of one of our members of the military who had been in Afghanistan, and then it was almost right out of Ellen DeGeneres' show. He magically appeared for his young daughter and wife to their great surprise. But it was also a whole series of others, including this 100-year-old surviving member of the Tuskegee Airmen. And all of that was done to great effect and brought an amazing and enormous reaction. The address itself, and give Trump credit for the discipline, which I know was difficult for him not to raise the impeachment issue, was a standard crafted address. But it was also filled, as every speech or statement by Trump is, with a bunch of flat-out lies about his record, about the state of the economy, about his position on health care. And that explains why Nancy Pelosi, having already had her hand put out for a handshake with the president coming into the speech, spurned with great fanfare, ripped the speech in half at the end and said afterwards, it's a bunch of lies. So presidents tend to exaggerate their accomplishments and minimize their setbacks and failures in State of the Union messages. But we've never seen anything like Donald Trump.
We also saw Rush Limbaugh, who sadly has been diagnosed with stage 4 lung cancer, seated next to the First Lady, who then was given the Medal of Freedom.
So I am sad for Rush Limbaugh. It's terrible that anybody has to go through a terrible disease and what appears to be a fatal disease. But the Medal of Freedom is the highest civilian honor to be given to an American. It's something that's given for not just achievement, but for exemplifying the best values of the United States. And by any standard, Rush Limbaugh does not exemplify the best values of the United States. He has spewed hatred, misogynistic, racist, and other comments. He's incited very bad things. And I don't think that we should vilify somebody just because of those things when they're ill, if they're not in the public spotlight. But not just awarding him the Medal of Freedom. And to be fair, presidents have a complete authority to decide who gets a Medal of Freedom. But to give him the medal instead of the way it's done in every other case, in the White House, in a ceremony with others by the president, to have the ceremony done in the gallery of the House in the Capitol by the First Lady is just another cheap trick. That's the only way I can frame it.
Norm, do you believe that this whole impeachment process, what we've gone through as citizens watching it, what the president and his supporters have gone through, has the presidency itself been changed by this process and what Donald Trump has accomplished by having such support in the Senate?
I fear that we have seen some permanent changes, and those changes may come in a variety of ways. There's an interesting column this week by Harry Lipman, who's a very smart former prosecutor, in the Washington Post, about whether the warning of the House managers that if Trump gets away with this, then any president can get away with anything, and saying that it's not the kind of precedent the way it is in the Supreme Court necessarily. It may not work that way, but I'm not so sure. I think this has debased the impeachment process in a way that may make it almost impossible as a standard in the future. More than that, every previous president, even those who've had some divisive elements to them, at least tried to reach out to the country as a whole and tried to be the president of the public as a whole. I'm thinking of some of the most eloquent speeches that I've ever heard. Ronald Reagan at Point du Hoc. Ronald Reagan after the Challenger exploded, getting out there and trying to exemplify our best values for the country as a whole. No previous president has doubled down repeatedly on a narrow base and pitted them against the rest of the country. Even presidents who've had a strategy of getting 50.1% of the votes and support. George W. Bush was in that position, Richard Nixon, but they had their moments as well, eloquent moments of reaching out to the country as a whole. If this becomes the new normal, we've got a bigger problem on our hands. At the same time, violating every standard of personal rectitude and behavior, keeping your businesses, refusing to give your tax returns, making money over and over again off of taxpayers, the amount of money that Trump has made for his own enterprises by charging the Secret Service a huge amount of money for the golf carts that they rent to protect him and follow him around. If that becomes a standard, God help us, we become a kleptocracy. And at the same time, we're now, by the standards of Glenn Kessler, who is the best of our fact checkers, up to close to 16,000 lies in 3 years of a president. If we lose that whole sense that you're bound by some sense of shame to try and be truthful, even if you exaggerate from time to time, lying every once in a while, sometimes in the national interest. But if this becomes the new normal, and if making presidential proclamations by tweets becomes the new normal, that's really not a normal we want to live with.
Norm, let's talk about the Iowa caucuses. This app, as we know, was a total failure. I'm interested not in the process, but in the results thus far. And Joe Biden did not show up very well.
No question. Now, I have, you know, as many do, real misgivings about the way our nominating processes have worked out for a long period of time. There's an overweening amount of influence given to Iowa and New Hampshire, and they are not representative of the country as a whole.
Of course.
Now, you know, the other side of that is it's not a bad idea to have candidates who have to go to a small state, interact with people face to face, get people, most of whom take this responsibility seriously, look at them and try and vet them in that way. But when you get an outcome which may involve 10, 50, or 100 people deciding who the winner is and who the losers are, and giving tremendous momentum for future contests, and then moving to another small state that also is overwhelmingly white and middle class and doesn't reflect the diversity of the country, not a great thing to do. Caucuses are not a great thing to do because they give tremendous weight to activists. It's not just showing up to vote, even. It's showing up and staying there for hours. It becomes an extraordinarily complex process because you go there and they make some initial count. And if your candidate, the one you support, doesn't have 15%, then you move to somebody else. And Iowa has gotten caught up with too much complexity. And it failed, obviously, this way. Now, for Joe Biden, the failure of the process was good news. If the results had emerged, say, as they were expected by 9 o'clock Eastern time or 10 o'clock Eastern time, and Joe Biden had finished a fairly distant fourth, the news the next day would have been about Biden stumbling. As it is, the news all that night and the news that went on for far more than a day had little to do with Joe Biden. So the sting of finishing fourth, even though it's Iowa and it doesn't really matter in terms of where his strength is, which is mostly with minority voters and the older African-American voters who are a solid base for him, but he didn't suffer the way he would have otherwise. But, you know, all of it just points out that this process is simply flawed from the start.
I've heard some analysts say that with his fourth place finish, and I grant you everything you've said is certainly true, with his fourth place finish, we're going into a brokered convention, a Democratic convention that Mayor Bloomberg is very likely to be on the stage as we go forward in debates, that he has hired 2,000 new people. He's put much more money into his own campaign and those of other Democrats. How important a figure do you see Mayor Bloomberg at this point?
The Iowa debacle was good news for Mayor Bloomberg. I would stop here, though, and issue one caution. Banish from your lexicon the phrase brokered convention, because there are no brokers. In the old days, if you go back even the very good Hollywood movie, The Best Man, from a Gore Vidal book with Cliff Robertson and Henry Fonda, where a small group of men in the proverbial smoke-filled room could move blocks of delegates around like pieces on a chessboard. Those brokers don't exist anymore. And even the candidates, you know, let's say that Bernie Sanders who has this group of true believers who come in as delegates to the convention. And Sanders instructs them to move to Elizabeth Warren, to block somebody else who he doesn't like as much. Can we be sure that those delegates are going to say, yes, Bernie, whatever you say, especially when they vilified Elizabeth Warren all along the way? So we could have a chaotic convention. Now, could we get to a convention without a presumptive nominee? The answer to that is yes. And these results in Iowa reinforce that possibility, at least. Remember that unlike the Republicans in 2016, Democrats don't have any contests where there's a winner-take-all. They're all divided proportionately in one form or another. You've got to reach a threshold of support, usually 15%, to get any delegates. But they're going to be divided up. Now, you can imagine moving forward a result in New Hampshire where Bernie Sanders, who won the last time, right next to Vermont, may win again, although we could also have four or five candidates fairly closely bunched together. You can imagine Joe Biden retaining enough support in South Carolina, which is going to have a heavily African-American vote. Biden prevailing there. Maybe Sanders or somebody else winning in Nevada, which also has caucuses and not a primary, and which is probably, since they were scheduled to use the same app, panicking right now about how they're going to run those caucuses. And then we move to this sweep of states in Super Tuesday. And that's where you get the Bloomberg effect, because we have some candidates who've raised a ton of money. Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg. You have Tom Steyer, who has his own money. But, you know, they've got $20 million, say. That's a lot of money. You move to a Super Tuesday with all of those states, and you're not going to spend everything that you have, but there are going to be states where you really are not going to be able to have much of a competitive advantage. Michael Bloomberg can spend untold sums in every single state, and his net worth will still go up. And that means it's very likely he will amass a significant number of delegates. Now, I think the candidacy is still dependent, his, on Biden stumbling badly. But let's say Biden doesn't stumble quite that badly. And if you're a candidate who's got some delegates, even though you're falling fairly far behind, and it looks like this may go to the convention, why would you drop out when you're going to have some ability to play a role at a convention and anything could happen? But I think we have to consider the possibility now that Bloomberg could be the one who emerges. And one of the interesting things about Bloomberg is nobody pushes Donald Trump's buttons the way that Michael Bloomberg does. Michael Bloomberg could buy and sell Donald Trump 100 times. And when Bloomberg said, when asked, what if it's two New York billionaires against each other, who's the other one? That drove Donald Trump up the wall. And we know that when Trump hit back by insulting his height and Bloomberg did a commercial about Trump's obesity, that Trump absolutely went bananas. So if Bloomberg were the Democratic nominee, it would push Trump close to the edge, and it would be a very interesting dynamic. Whether the Democratic Party could do that and not have an absolute rebellion from the Sanders left and probably end up with a Tulsi Gabbard or a Jill Stein as an independent candidate, maybe replicating what we saw in 2016, that we can't predict. But right now, all we can say about the Democratic nominating process is we don't really have a clue who's going to prevail.
Norton Morenstein, as always, thank you.
It's an unending pleasure to continue to interact with you, Diane.
Thank you. And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Uriv-Libker and Cliff Gallagher. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.